This is side two of For the Record, program number 816, revisiting the 1972 Olympics massacre. This is being recorded on October 23rd of the year 2014. And surprise, surprise, I'm Dave Emery. We're going to plunge right back in where we left off at the end of side one. We have been reading from a Der Spiegel article from August 28th of 2012, Germany's Secret Contacts to Palestinian Terrorists. This is co-authored by Felix Bohr, Gunter Lotsch, and Klaus Weigreffer. And we are going to plunge right in and skipping down. We read, the Munich attack, and this, by the way, talking about very cozy relations between German officials and the Black September PLO faction that perpetrated the massacre, as we will see. A similar relationship obtained between elements of U.S. intelligence and U.S. officialdom as well. The Munich attack had occurred only 6 months earlier, despite the still vivid images of masked terrorists on the balconies of the Olympic Village and the burned-out helicopter on the tarmac at the NATO airbase that Fürstenfeldbruck, that's Fürstenfeldbruck, there was already active but secret diplomatic communication between Germans and Palestinians. West German representatives were talking to men like Abu Youssef, Ali Hassan Salome, and Amin al-Hindi, all of the masterminds of the Munich murders. Even the German Federal Criminal Police Office, or BKA, parenthetically headed up by Hans Kolmar, whom I alluded to in side one, which is obligated to prosecute criminals, was involved in meetings, according to documents in the political archives of the German Foreign Ministry and the Federal Archive in the western city of Koblenz, K-O-B-L-E-N-Z, which Der Spiegel has now analyzed, skipping down. And this, by the way, again from August of 2012. In the coming weeks, during events to mark the 40th anniversary of the attack, the question will once again be raised as to why the German courts never tried any of the perpetrators or backers of the Munich massacre. The documents that are now available suggest one answer in particular. West Germany didn't want to call them to account. In the first few weeks after the attack, German government offices in Bonn were imbued with a spirit of appeasement. From the Israeli perspective, it felt like a bitter irony of history that it involved Munich, a city that became a symbol of the Western powers' appeasement of Hitler after the Munich Agreement permitted Nazi Germany's annexation of the Sudetenland that was signed there in 1938. Although the Munich attack involved multiple murders, the language in the files oddly downplays what happened there. Then Chancellor Brandt is quoted as saying that the Olympics massacre was a, quote, crazy incident, unquote, while Paul Frank, a state secretary to the foreign ministry, refers to it simply as, quote, the events in Munich, unquote. Diplomats and senior interior ministry officials upgraded the status of Black September by calling it a, quote, resistance group, unquote, as if its acts of terror had been directed against Hitler and not Israeli civilians. At the foreign ministry in particular, some officials were apparently very sympathetic to the Palestinians. Walter Nowak, the N-O-W-A-K, the German ambassador to Lebanon, once told Abu Youssef that the Germans were a people, quote, with a substantial number of refugees, unquote, because of the fact that ethnic Germans had been expelled from parts of Central and Eastern Europe after World War II. Nowak himself was born in Silesia, which is now part of Poland, back when it belonged to Germany. This, he added, made them more understanding of the Palestinian situation than other nations. Parenthetically, the treatment of groups were expelled from Poland, Czechoslovakia, and elsewhere at the end of World War II because they had provided a very active fifth column, which not only was used as a pretext for the German aggressions against Czechoslovakia and Poland, but they actively helped with the atrocities that the Nazis committed after they occupied those countries. There is very good discussion of that, by the way, in the book The New Germany and the Old Nazis, by T.H. Tettens, and that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Continuing with this article, it is clear that the Federal Criminal Office, or BKA, cooperated with the PLO, as evidenced by a telex from the embassy in Beirut reporting on a meeting between Hindi and a BKA official on June 14, 1980. According to the message, Hindi complained that the press had gotten wind of the connections between the PLO and the BKA. He also claimed that the leak was on the German side. An indiscretion like this could jeopardize cooperation, Hindi threatened, telling the BKA official that either the two organizations, quote, continue working together in secret or not at all, unquote. Hindi died of cancer in 2010, and most of the others behind the Munich massacre are now dead as well. One of the three terrorists whose release the PLO secured by hijacking of the Lufthansa flight occasionally appears in documentary films. There is still a German warrant out for his arrest, but there is nothing to suggest that the German authorities have ever tried to find him. Given these circumstances, there is every indication that he will not be tried for the murder of the 11 Israelis and a German police officer, at least not in a German court. The Germany Watch blogspot, which feeds along the lower right-hand side of the front page of the SpitfireList.com website, had an insightful post from August 30th of 2012. It's titled Munich 1972, Further Disclosures. And some of the elements of discussion here. Note, first of all, that there were three more Palestinian terrorists at the airport than had previously been reported. The number jumped from five to eight. The question remains as to who those other three were. Since the German counter-terror plan involved sniping some of the PLO terrorists, why didn't the Germans bring rifles to the airport? And, again, why was there not more security taken in advance of the Olympics massacre in light of the fact that the German government had advanced warning? And also, the Israelis offered to assist with the counter-terror operation. The Germans refused. Again, from Germany Watch, August 30th of 2012, Munich, 1972, Further Disclosures. Here are just some of the highlights. When the Black September terrorists left the Olympic site in helicopters in order to fly to the airport to meet their plane, there were five terrorists. When the standoff and shootings happened at the Munich airport, there were suddenly eight terrorists. The three extra terrorists took the Israeli Mossad chief, who was present at the airport, by surprise. He questioned the Germans on this and did not get a clear explanation, and Germany Watch opines, because they were the German contacts already in the helicopters waiting at the Olympic site. It was these three that survived the shootings and were later released. The others were expendable. They were released, by the way, after a hijacking of a Lufthansa plane. In past programs, we've taken a look at the fact that François Genoux was deeply involved with that. He was a key Nazi operative and banker and involved with the post-war Nazi diaspora, the post-war disbursement of Nazi funds, one of the apparent founders of the Bank Altaqua, and the heir to the political last will and testament and collected literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. And again, those were the three who mysteriously materialized at the airport, whereas previously there had only been five reported terrorists. Continuing with the Germany Watch article of August 30th of 2012. Despite requests for security of the Israeli team before the incident, German police laughed off the need for security for the team, saying it was, quote, not in the Olympic spirit, unquote. Despite knowing their own plan for supposedly retrieving the hostages included sniping the terrorists at the airport, the Germans did not bring any rifles. They were armed with pistols and machine pistols. This meant that when they opened fire, quote, German bullets were spraying about, unquote, potentially including the possibility that some of the athletes were actually shot by Germans. So again, the sudden jump in the number of terrorists from 5 to 8, the absence of rifles at the airport on the part of the German security personnel, the lack of security, all of these things are very, very interesting and important questions indeed. Now, I'm going to recap some information we looked at in For the Record 806. I want to stress most emphatically that this is speculative. I am not saying necessarily that there was a relationship between the Olympics massacre and the Kissinger-Nixon collaboration with German Third Reich alumni in the Little Service to destabilize the Willy Brandt government because of its Ostpolitik, but I am asking the question, might that have been the case? In order to basically solidify our understanding of Henry Kissinger's CD, from John Loftus's book, America's Nazi Secret, by Prime Day, softcover edition, we read the following about Kissinger. Kissinger was recruited as a professional spy for Alan Dulles shortly after the end of the war in Europe. Although there is no evidence that he personally recruited Nazis, Kissinger ran the intelligence file room where records of Nazi recruitment were kept. He then transferred to Harvard, where he specialized in recruiting foreign students for espionage. Later, he worked for Dulles during the glory days of the Office of Policy Coordination, or OPC. He was hired as a consultant for a private group known as Operations Research Office, which planned to use former Nazis as agents behind Russian lines in the event of World War III. Mention of Kissinger's classified work was censored from the original manuscript of this book. That, by the way, was the book The Ballara Secret, which came out in 1982, hardcover edition by Alfred A. Knopf. The uncensored version was republished in softcover by Prime Day Publishers. And again, the title, America's Nazi Secret. So that is some of the background of Henry Kissinger. We're going to recap Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon, and their collaboration with Third Reich alumni in Germany, including Reinhard Gehlen, to destabilize the Brandt government. The following is from the Daily Mail of the United Kingdom from December 3rd of 2012. It's an article by Alan Hall, H-A-L-L, titled Kissinger and the Secret Spy Network of Old Nazis and German Aristocrats, quote, who plotted to overthrow the West German government. Again, Daily Mail, December 3rd of 2012, reads in part, a German academic has unearthed evidence showing how former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger once discussed a coup with disgruntled Nazis to overthrow the West German government in the 1970s. Kissinger and Richard Nixon were agreed that the left-leaning government of the day's burgeoning friendship with the hardline East German government. Kissinger became the contact man for a secret spy network made up of old Nazis and elite aristocrats aimed at torpedoing the plans formulated by Chancellor Willy Brandt. By the end of 1970, Kissinger was offering the spies advice on how to deal with Brandt's social democratic government. The group he became embroiled with was called the Little Service and was formed by the Conservative Christian Democratic Union, or CDU, which was allied with Bavaria's Christian Social Union, or CSU. One agent who visited Kissinger quoted him as saying, quote, "It might be possible to overthrow the current government, but it remains to be seen whether this would involve risks which could put a Christian Democratic Union or Christian Social Union government in great difficulty," unquote. Brandt, skipping down, Brandt pursued a policy of engagement with the German Democratic Republic, parenthetically the former East Germany, convinced it was better to build bridges with the dictatorship to defuse Cold War tensions rather than always being at loggerheads. For the all-white, all-male conservatives of the CDU, this was too much. They wanted West Germany to face off against a Soviet-backed regime in the belief that isolation would make it crumble. It was out of this belief that its private spy organization, made up of many former Gestapo and SS men, as well as titled barons and counts, was formed. Political scientist Stephanie Vaske, W-A-S-K-E, spent 7 years researching letters from politicians from the Christian Democratic Union and its Bavarian sister party, the CSU, and her results are to be published next year, potentially embarrassing timing for Chancellor Angela Merkel, who in November of 2013 will seek re-election as CDU Chancellor for the third time. Vaske approached Kissinger for comment, but he refused, as did many of the noblemen who worked for the Little Service, which came into being in 1969 after the party lost its first general election since the post-war republic was formed in 1949. Details of her research are published in the current edition of the German intellectual weekly Die Zeit. The catalyst for the spy group was Brandt's decision to recognize post-World War II borders dividing Germany and a pledge Brandt gave that his state would not use violence against the communist one in the East. Conservative MP Karl Theodor Freiherr zu Guttenberg, who was the grandfather of the disgraced former defense minister who had to resign last year after it was discovered that he cheated on his doctorate, held a meeting in the autumn of 1969 with former German Chancellor Kurt Georg Kiesinger, not to be confused with Henry Kissinger, and leading CDU and CSU politicians, the CSU being the Bavarian wing of the party. By the way, Kurt Georg Kiesinger was in charge of radio propaganda for Goebbels' propaganda ministry in World War II. Continuing, they decided to form an information service for the opposition, said Vaske. It was a secret spy service. The former head of the BND, Germany's foreign intelligence agency, was tapped, and he offered up a ready-made web of informants across the globe in countries as far apart as the U.S., France, and Saudi Arabia. Parenthetically, at this point in time, there was only one former BND chief. That was Reinhard Gehlen. Hans Christoph von Stauffenberg, the cousin of the man who tried and failed to kill Hitler in the July 1944 bomb plot, was chosen to head the network. Casimir Prince of Sayn-Wittgenstein, who would later only narrowly miss imprisonment for the CDU's party donation scandal of a decade ago, was recruited to raise hundreds of thousands of Deutschmarks necessary to fund the network. He collected from conservatives in industry, many of whom had previously supported Hitler and who now viewed with suspicion the apparent coziness developing between Brandt and the communists. The first act was to open up a secret back channel to Kissinger, who was then keen to know what the Soviets were up to at all times, including their puppets in East Berlin. And one of the key members of this network, from the Daily Telegraph of December 3rd of 2012, West Germany's CDU had private spy service by Matthew Day. That fellow was Hans Globke, who was the Eminence Grise, the great eminence behind Konrad Adenauer. He helped to draw up the Nuremberg Laws, which were the legal basis for the Nazi atrocities in World War II. So again, bearing in mind Henry Kissinger's significant role in the in helping to destabilize the Brandt government. Consider the following: the fact that Ali Hassan Salome, one of the planners of the Olympics massacre, was working for CIA within a year after the attacks. This is an excerpt from AFA number 22.
An interesting article about Ali Hassan Salome indicating that he also worked for the CIA appeared in the Wall Street Journal of February 10th, 1983. It's by David Ignatius, a Wall Street Journal reporter, and it's headlined, PLO operative slain reputedly by Israelis had been helping U.S. Subtitled, figure in Munich massacre died in a 1979 explosion. Role in diplomat safety. Arafat's American channel? Question mark. Dateline Washington. On January 22, 1979, an official of the Palestine Liberation Organization named Ali Hassan Salome was killed in a car bomb explosion in Beirut. One of the most notorious PLO terrorists during the early 1970s, he had helped plan the seizure of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Summer Olympics in Munich. We have lost a lion, said PLO chairman Yasser Arafat. Mr. Salome's corpse carried a hint that he was an unusual lion. In one of the dead man's pockets, according to a close friend, was a message sent that day from Bashir Jamal, the leader of the Lebanese Falangist militia and normally a ferocious enemy of the PLO, warning Mr. Salome that his life was in danger. Shortly after the assassination, Admiral Stansfield Turner, then the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, briefed President Carter on the incident. The CIA's information about who had killed Mr. Salome wasn't conclusive, but senior Carter administration officials say they suspected it was the Israelis. These officials say that despite Mr. Salome's terrorist background, President Carter expressed concern, unquote, at his death. The reason for President Carter's dismay was that for over 5 years, Mr. Salome, with Mr. Arafat's apparent approval, had been providing the CIA with intelligence that helped protect U.S. diplomats from extremist attacks by Palestinians and other Arabs. He had also helped implement an understanding with the U.S. Turning the page here. He had also helped implement an understanding with the U.S. reached in November of 1973 that Mr. Arafat's PLO mainstream group, Fatah, wouldn't harm Americans. Moreover, according to a top U.S. official, the U.S. had reason to believe that the Israelis knew, unquote, that Mr. Salome was secretly helping the U.S. The Salome connection, which amounted to a backdoor channel between the U.S. and the PLO, is one of the most intriguing tales to emerge from the conspiracy-laden Middle East. It illustrates the complex intelligence operations undertaken by the U.S., the PLO, and the Israelis in this region. It also shows how, on occasion, U.S. and Israeli interests can differ sharply. Skipping down in the article. In mid-1973, Mr. Arafat and Mr. Salome began their opening to the U.S. for the PLO. The dialogue offered the prospect of eventual U.S. recognition of Palestinian rights. For the U.S., it offered a chance to curb terrorism against Americans, such as the March 1973 murder of two U.S. diplomats in Khartoum by a faction of Black September. The chronology of this secret U.S. PLO diplomacy is outlined by former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger in his recent volume of memoirs, Years of Upheaval, unquote. According to Mr. Kissinger, contacts began in late July of 1973 and climaxed in a secret meeting on November 3rd in Rabat, Morocco, between General Vernon Walters, then deputy director of the CIA, and a senior PLO official. The meeting produced what amounted to a non-aggression pact between the U.S. and Fatah. Mr. Kissinger writes that, quote, attacks on Americans, at least by Arafat's faction of the PLO, ceased, unquote. Mr. Salome, as chief of Fatah security, was responsible for enforcing this new policy. The first test came in December 16, 1973, when Mr. Kissinger visited Lebanon. Mr. Salome's friends say he advised the U.S. there might be an attempt in Beirut on Mr. Kissinger's life. Mr. Kissinger notes in his book, quote, a report that there was a plan to shoot down my plane, unquote. So the Kissinger plane was diverted to a Lebanese air base at Rayak in the Baca Valley east of Beirut. A Beirut source says that Mr. Salome marshaled a force of 6,000 people to protect Mr. Kissinger during this brief visit. And skipping down still further. Mr. Salome's help with security wasn't limited to the U.S. and his friends and his friend. Excuse me, starting again. Mr. Salome's help with security wasn't limited to the U.S., his friends in Beirut say. They say he tipped off the Saudis about various plots, including a plan by the PFLP to infiltrate saboteurs through South Yemen to blow up Saudi oil facilities. He provided assistance to security officials from West Germany, Italy, and Japan who were seeking information about links between their own domestic terrorists and Palestinian extremists. And in 1977, after Anwar Sadat's trip to Jerusalem, Mr. Salameh helped pass information to Egypt about a Libyan-backed plot against Mr. Sadat. Skipping down still further, about the organization that Salameh headed up. Only 37 years old when he died, he headed Mr. Arafat's Fatah Security and Intelligence Unit with up to 3,700 members and a monthly budget of $1.5 million. The unit was known as Squad 17, apparently because Mr. Salameh's office was Extension 17 on the PLO military telephone network. Remember Squad 17. I'm going to read that last couple of sentences again because Squad 17 is going to figure prominently here. Only 37 years old when he died, Salameh that is, he headed Mr. Arafat's Fatah Security and Intelligence Unit with up to 3,700 members and a monthly budget of $1.5 million. The unit was known as Squad 17, apparently because Mr. Salameh's office was Extension 17 on the PLO military telephone network. We're going to be coming back to Squad 17 near the end of the broadcast. It's something which is very much with us these days. The last section of this Wall Street Journal article from 2/10/83 that I'm going to read you is the following. Born April 1st, 1941, Mr. Salameh was the son of a well-known Palestinian militant named Sheikh Hassan Salameh. Sheikh Hassan was a leader of the Palestinian resistance movement headed by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin Husseini. During the 1948 fighting that led to the creation of Israel, Sheikh Hassan was killed by an Israeli bomb. The family eventually fled to Cairo. Now here are the two of the key names for the section we're about to get into. One is Sheikh Hassan Salameh, the father of Ali Hassan Salameh, the fellow credited with planning the Olympics massacre of 1972, and a man who, as we've seen, by July of 1973, was establishing contacts with the U.S. and providing security information to the CIA within less than a year of having accomplished the Olympics massacre.
That, again, from AFA program number 22, recorded in August of 1986. In connection with that, I note the following. We don't have time to read the article. It is a long one. This is yet another story from Der Spiegel. This from January 2nd of 2013 by Karen Osman, ASSMAN, and the same journalist who wrote the other story, Klaus Weigreffer, Gunter Lotsch, and Felix Bohr. One man, three lies. The Munich Olympics and the CIA's new informant. And this is about the fact that Willy Pohl, a.k.a. Willy Voss, the German neo-Nazi who assisted Black September with the attacks, was also working as a CIA operative by the 1970s. So again, what relationship may exist between Henry Kissinger, his work with the Little Service to destabilize Willy Brandt, and the fact that both Ali Hassan Salameh, one of the planners of the massacre, and Willy Pohl, the German neo-Nazi, or maybe one of the German neo-Nazis who assisted, is there any relationship between those phenomena? This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 816, revisiting the 1972 Olympics massacre. This is being recorded on October 23rd of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.